Would you consider him to be an autocrat?
Yeah, definitely.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast. Hello, Rob. How are you?
Oh, I'm delightful. I am in sunny Michigan, which is...
back in the old country.
One of my favorite places to be. Yeah, the Midwest, I suppose, is on my mother's side, the old country, and happy to be here. How are things with you?
Yeah, things are going very well. Just working away. Nothing too exciting. The weather's changed. It seems to be very tropical at the moment, so it's either very sunny or torrential rain. So we're currently in the rain phase, which I'm enjoying.
The nice thing is that up here, even as the country gets hotter and hotter, I think we had some of the world's hottest days. Already?
Yeah, I think it was at 17 degrees average.
Something along those lines. 63-ish, I think, in Fahrenheit, which is a very high average temperature. But up here in Michigan, we use the air conditioner. There's one air conditioner in the house. We use it a little more often than we used to. But today is a beautiful day. You can wear pants or swim. You know, it's great.
Okay, yeah. Brilliant.
Big fan. Big fan of Northern Michigan, and everyone should spend more time here.
Are there any other parts of the world you'd like to go to swim?
Wow, that was, I feel like it's one of your more desperate segues. But today we are talking about El Salvador. And I feel like I should say at the outset that El Salvador is not a country that I've paid much attention to, despite it being at the center of a number of controversies in recent years. But over the past 4 days, this has been my main topic of research, and I'll confess that I'm fascinated. The country and Nayib Bukele himself, the very controversial president of the country, that we will
probably... This is why you don't let young people in charge.
Exactly. They want to do things.
Mm-hmm. And they know how the internet works.
I'm really grateful, actually, for the opportunity to... dive into this at length. And I think I've come up with a few interesting things worth saying, but bear in mind that I'm very new to anything like Central American expertise.
So whereabouts do you believe El Salvador's modern history begins?
Oof, well, that's a great question. I have developed very limited picture of their 19th century history. What's stunning to me is I didn't realize how long, there's so much we just don't realize about Central America. It's easy to forget these countries. Mexico and then the many countries of South America are more sizable, both in geographical terms and in terms of population. El Salvador has just 6 million people. It is in a tiny, tiny footprint, and it is surrounded by countries like Belize that have similar issues. El Salvador is smaller than Guatemala or Honduras or Nicaragua. But those countries have similarly small populations. It's interesting that El Salvador's population seems to have stopped growing. I couldn't quite parse why that was. I thought maybe it's the Civil War, but it seems to have stopped growing after the Civil War. I don't know if that is migration. It's not that it has stopped growing, but it is growing at a much slower clip than neighbors, which may say some interesting things about the country. But in the 19th century, these rather small countries made a series of efforts to have a larger footprint, to be a bigger deal. And it seems like a lot of the politics of the 19th century is about, are we going to try to have a Central American Republic? There were at least two efforts at it. They fell apart. And I think that that would lead to a level of governing chaos that makes it kind of hard to parse the history of 19th century El Salvador in a couple days. But perhaps I'll return to it in some day. By the 20th century, it becomes a more typically depressing story with some real standout darkness that I feel is worth mentioning. Indigo was El Salvador's main product, I recall reading, and then commercial dyes made that redundant. Coffee has been a big focus. 20th century history of El Salvador is as a resource-producing country and one that is... as a small country abused by its neighbors and by its elites. There was sort of a series of dictators, just early 20th century. This was so standout and so rough to look at. Guatemala and El Salvador, the neighboring countries, have some pretty serious negative history. They've fought wars against each other. The contrast between them is that Guatemala has a lot more space than El Salvador does. Guatemala has far surpassed El Salvador in population terms, maybe double the size now, but that's not always the case. And another real contrast is that Guatemala has a really serious indigenous population, whereas El Salvador does not. Surprised by that, actually, the extent to which the indigenous are not a factor. And what I was somewhat horrified to learn was that some of that is rather hard work done in the 20th century. So we sort of associate the genocides of being sort of a 19th century or a disease-related thing in earlier centuries. But in this absolutely obscene historical event called La Matanza, there was an uprising in the 1930s, combination communist and indigenous uprising, and the dictatorship at the time responded with a massacre. La Matanza, I believe, means massacre or slaughter in Spanish, killing 10 to 40,000 primarily indigenous people. The current indigenous population of El Salvador, a country of 6 million or so, is estimated around 10,000. This massacre killed 10 to 40,000 people. It's just absolutely stunning. And to really just sort of complete this and give you a picture of who the United States was supporting in the 20th century, the United States, in a somewhat principled thing, had refused to recognize the dictatorship that carried out the La Matanza because it had come to power illegitimately. This was in the period, beginning to get into the period of the New Deal, where we were trying to be a little nicer. So as a matter of principle, we didn't recognize this dictatorship until they massacred all of these folks that they described as communists.
Oh.
Actually, the United States decided to recognize the dictatorship of El Salvador that lasted for another decade in the 1940s because of this genocidal massacre.
Because tribes people are known to be up on world affairs and choosing political ideals.
It's just incredibly grim. It's just incredibly grim. So that just should give you a sense of who we've been supporting in El Salvador. We get into the horrific civil war, 1979 to 1992. This was part of the truly abysmal Reagan-era Central America policy. A lot of the same, frankly, malicious idiots that carried out that policy were then let loose on Iraq and other countries in the global war on terror. This was sort of a proving ground. And as you might expect from how the global war on terror turned out, it was a murderous failure in Central America as well. The government that we supported in El Salvador seems to mostly be remembered for murdering Catholic priests. That seems to be one of their main things to do, in between slaughtering whole villages. These were our guys. The El Mozote massacre, I had mistakenly thought that had taken place in Guatemala, but that would have actually taken place in El Salvador. 800 folks murdered in an afternoon, women, children, etc. And the sort of launching of the civil war was an assassination of a Catholic priest who spoke out against government violence in 1979. And actually what finally ended the civil war was the withdrawal of U.S. support for the government, prompted by another massacre of a bunch of Jesuit students. Absolutely horrific, abysmal thing that we've entirely forgotten in the United States. And not only did we entirely forget it, we hired all the guys who did that, who were responsible for that, and promoted them during the Bush administration. Elliot Abrams is a really gross Trump appointee who was famously taken to task by Ilhan Omar a couple of years back for his role in covering up the El Mozote massacre specifically. And Joe Biden just appointed him to a new position.
Well, you wouldn't want to cause controversy by not agreeing with Trump, would you?
Yeah. He's on a commission. He's not, you know, as directly linked in to Trump Latin America policy as he was. Trump made this guy the special envoy for Venezuela and Iran. I mean, he really elevated this guy.
Wow.
And Biden has made him, what about a commission for public diplomacy or something like that? It's a much smaller position, but the fact that Biden has appointed him to anything is an outrage. And I think on this channel, we fall into the idea that, it was Trump that really screwed up our Latin America policy. And I think that's true. I think that's true, frankly. Trump and Republicans before him have been much worse on Latin American policy. But the continued employment and impunity of these people, like Elliot Abrams, who can be fairly described as a genocidaire, the continued impunity and employment of these people is dependent on Democrats doing absolutely nothing.
Because okay. I know the Republicans at a point were trying to focus on Latin America as potential voters, as in, you know, Latin Americans within America. But that seems to have really gone by the wayside.
Well, it's actually a huge factor now. It's now being noticed and encouraged by Republican activists again, which it was not for a period of time, certainly the early Trump administration. Latinos are voted for Trump in higher numbers the second time around than they did the first time around. And I think the breakdown, that's a much, much larger issue, but I think that for different reasons, both the Democrats and the Republicans participated in a truly fantastical idea that Latinos were a monolith, that we're always going to vote Democratic. And that's simply, that was never the case. But how that works for foreign policy is that a lot of, and this will play into the success of Nayib Bukele in El Salvador, a lot of the Latinos in the United States really hate the governments of the places that they left. They left as refugees, specifically in the Venezuelan or Cuban context, that comes in the form of rabid anti-communism specifically, but is not necessarily, even if they are more progressive or democratic voting, even among those populations of Latinos, relatively new to the U.S. Latinos that are in that coalition, they don't necessarily have any great sympathy for these governments. Let's remember that a lot of the folks who come to the United States come from more marginalized populations, peasants that have been pushed off the land. I think it does definitely trend, certainly the Mexican population in the United States trends much more indigenous than the mestizo or flatly white population is also on top of socioeconomic distribution. So yeah, these are very, very big issues that maybe we could do a whole nother episode on at some point. But question of El Salvador and this horrific, horrific civil war provides probably the point at which our story should start, because
it comes to an end at around 1992 with a peace agreement that I'm going to struggle to pronounce. Chapinse Peace Accords.
Was it Chapultepec?
Chapultepec, that's it.
I'm not entirely certain myself. But there is, and this is something about George Bush, the first George Bush, that is underappreciated, is that you had all of these belligerent morons like Elliot Abrams or Robert Kagan or dead, horrible people that were able to do whatever they wanted in Central America because it didn't really matter much. Because you had a lot of really vicious people giving a lot of money to the Republican Party, and they had to be let to have free reign and murder and kill in Central America because it didn't really matter. And George Bush and James Baker were doing high politics with the Soviets that actually mattered. George Bush, the first one, to his credit, shut down a lot of the lunatics. And this may, in fact, be part of why he did not get reelected. Despite being the guy in charge when we won the Cold War, he was not willing to continue to let these monsters, you know, there was just a certain number of murdered Catholic priests that was too many for the first Bush. And that may be a low bar, but that's pretty good for a U.S. president, that he did reach a level of murdered women, children, and priests that he was no longer willing to put up with. And not just in El Salvador, but in Nicaragua, in a number of other places, Bush did the work to shut down this nightmare. The fascinating thing is that the U.S. was heavily supporting the El Salvadoran government against the FMLN, which was a guerrilla group. And unlike Colombia, where things are still dragging on, or, you know, every 3 years, we're like, oh, it's a peace agreement with the next group. It was actually fairly straightforward in El Salvador. As a smaller, more geographically compact place, the FMLN became, this guerrilla group, became a stable part of a new two-party system in 1992. And that may not sound like much of an accomplishment, but it is extraordinary that the U.S. government allowed that to happen, especially when you just consider the level of vindictiveness.
Because they are considered left-wing, which you could easily construe as communist.
Absolutely. They were communist in origin. And I think it's a sense of maturity to some degree that the first Bush and continued in some places by the Clinton administration. I call it the humanitarian house cleaning. There were a lot of really, really, and some of this even started under Reagan, which was, of course, a lot of his more sensible foreign policy was guided by Bush and Bundesmacht or George Shultz, who's also generally not too dumb a guy until he started supporting Theranos. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. The humanitarian house cleaning was real and it was significant and it brought great democratization to the world. Essentially, the United States just stopping supporting the particularly hellish groups that we had supported in Central America. South Africa, apartheid South Africa was another big, into the Reagan era, big U.S. Cold War proxy. So part of this, it seems like there were people who were paying attention enough in the U.S. government to know that they should just back off. And that's what they did. And El Salvador has had a largely stable two-party system with orderly transitions of power 1992 until 2019.
Is it the Arena Party would be the more right-wing one?
Exactly.
So it's been mostly Arena with about four presidents, and then FMLN had two goes at it after that. But yeah, as far as politics goes, fairly peaceful.
Fairly peaceful. Fairly peaceful. And I think that's an accomplishment to be celebrated. But, and there's some, you know, I read a Congressional Research Service report on, so this is what the U.S. Congress as research arm thinks of El Salvador. And it was interesting because they're clearly, pretty clearly trying to make the case that the government before Nayib Bukele was to be celebrated. They include statistics talking about how poverty fell in, you know, just the 2014 to 2019 period. Poverty fell from 44.5% to 30.4%. Extreme poverty fell from 11.4% to 5.6%. Of course, these standards are always very controversial. These measures are, of course, very, very low numbers. And often, this is something I've seen and talked about from Ethiopia to other countries, certainly a factor in China. Getting people out of poverty actually gives them the leisure to be much, much more unhappy with the government. If you're dealing with subsistence farming, if you're dealing with just trying to get put one thing in front of another, you don't have the leisure of getting involved in politics or having a political opinion. And I think that the FMLN and Arena duopoly managed to accomplish to a degree getting El Salvadorans up to a level of the ability to put their head up and pay attention, and they did not like what they saw. They did not like the levels of corruption of this group, and most importantly, they did not like the levels of crime.
Yes, it had the highest murder rates in the world at one point.
Yes, and again, this is something that defenders of the old regime like to point out. Well, it was already falling before Bukele came into power.
Definitely around, 2015. Since then, it's sort of gone off a cliff, thankfully.
Thankfully. I think that folks were angry enough with the duopoly that had been in power that they were not eager to give them credit for that. And it's, I think this is the advent of Bukele is sort of begins in the teens. You know, he's described as a businessman, which is kind of interesting for a guy who started out in public service at the age of 31. You know, how much businessmanning can you get up to? He is certainly, Nayib Bukele is certainly positioned as a pro-business guy. He did start out in the FMLN, the more left-leaning party, but that has not really been his public persona.
Apparently they were worried he was too popular.
Too popular, yes. That's well, sure, the FMLN, like any party hierarchy, has folks that should be in power, you know, that feel that they earned their position, they've put in the time, they put in the decades, and to have some 30-something come in and sort of pronounce that he should be the next president.
And he knows best.
Was definitely very threatening. And he, unfortunately, the FMLN sort of took a knife to a gunfight because they kicked him out of the party, and he rather quickly, apparently he formed his own new party, but he couldn't get it on the ballot in time, so he sort of...
So was he the mayor of San Salvador before that?
Well, so from 2012 to 2015, he was the mayor of Nuevo Cuscatlan. Seems like a suburb or exurb of San Salvador, the capital. And then from 2015 to 2018, he was the mayor of San Salvador. And he apparently, according to one YouTube video that I saw that was just shockingly, it was a Wendover Productions that was just shockingly adulatory of Bukele. I mean, it's nominally pretending there's a conversation to be had about him, but it honestly seemed like a campaign video. So he apparently completely turned around Nuevo Cuscatlan, then had many positive effects in San Salvador, had a big falling out with his party, attached himself not to the New Ideas Party that he has founded, but an older party that was just sort of around that he could get on the ballot with. And in June 2019, he became president, but in elections prior to that, won an absolutely shocking blow-him-out-of-the-water victory. He got 53% of the vote in a system that is typically much more fragmented. There didn't need to be a runoff, and he became president. He was already making waves within a year of his presidency, and he came to international attention in ways that certainly made me dislike him, from what little I knew about him. In 2020, was it in February of 2020? But he basically invaded the parliament. Do you remember that, those visuals?
Yes, he brought in his, he's been very militant. So he's been very tough on the gangs, which is sort of one of the two things we'll probably know about. And yeah, they were not so keen on one of his policies, and a lot of men in balaclavas with assault rifles came into the parliament, and it sort of changed their mind.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out, though, that he actually has had very different policies over the course of just his 4 years in power. Initially, and this is what's interesting, El Salvador, we talk a lot about the abuse of sanctions on this channel, and I would definitely include this in the one of the abuses of sanctions. Significant chunks of his government are under sanctions by the United States. We do not do broad-based sanctions of El Salvador, thank God. I think we recognize, especially with the number of refugees, asylum seekers, what have you, showing up on our borders, that obviously sanctioning El Salvador would make that a lot worse.
Oh, definitely.
Because we know, we don't admit that we know, but we know that when we do broad-based sanctions, we're murdering people and we're murdering the economies of these countries.
And it's best if they don't have access to a land border with America.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we're not doing that to, we're not doing broad-based sanctions to El Salvador, but we have targeted sanctions against multiple members of Bukele's government. And what's fascinating about this is he's now become internationally famous for his very hard line against the cartels. That started in March of 2022, but we were actually sanctioning him under the Trump and Biden administrations, because we felt that he was too close to the gangs.
Well, that's always been the rumor, that he had an agreement with the gangs, but it would appear that every politician has an agreement with the gangs.
Yes, and I think that to the extent that the FMLN government prior to Bukele was able to drop crime, they were able to do so because of agreements with the gangs.
Definitely. Do you know how many people were in gangs in El Salvador?
I don't have the numbers for that.
It's believed to be around 60,000, which is 1% of their population.
Wow. That's crazy.
It is staggering and terrifying. So the murder rate would be at its height would be about 20 times more than America and 100 times bigger than the UK.
Jeez. Yeah. It was a really just terrifying place. It was a
absolutely
place would not visit, and now I'm contemplating a trip there, which says something about Bukele.
Yeah, it was weird. I was seeing like YouTuber vloggers going to it recently, which I don't think they would have done 5-7 years ago.
No. So he has, I think there's two periods of Bukele's government thus far. I believe he is, in 2024, he faces another election. This is one element democracy lovers are complaining about. El Salvador constitutionally has one-term presidents. He has already said he's going to run anyway. He's gotten the constitutional, or he's gotten a Supreme Court to endorse that.
Which he's kind of packed as well, hasn't he?
He has. He has. But I do think it is, I think it's an interesting question that gets fundamentally to what you think about democracy. If Nayib Bukele was pulling these kinds of moves in the United States, in my country, or in one state within my country, I would want him to be in jail. I would want him, and that is, but that's very much about where I'm situated.
Mm-hmm. Well, America is very stable in comparison.
Yeah. I mean, I am stable. I have means to feed myself, clothe myself, et cetera, et cetera. I feel that while I certainly feel like my governing system is corrupt in a number of ways, I think it is corrupt in a number of ways that are correctable through the usual means. The fundamental question here is very Jeffersonian. Thomas Jefferson, the guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence, I believe, was the third president of the United States, very important founding father, is also famously one of the more radical among the founding fathers. And, you know, one of his famous quotes is that the tree of liberty needs to be watered with the blood of patriots every generation or something like that, which is something that I think he backed off of a bit. But it is a fundamental question among not just, you know, more recent, more rabid revolutionaries, but among just the first folks who set up modern representative government. Like, at a certain point, if the government is not serving the needs of the people, and Wendover Productions says there's a clause that reflects this in the El Salvadoran Constitution, you know, if it's not serving the needs of the people, like, is it appropriate for
it functional?
More extra legal, more extra constitutional measures to be taken? And Bukele, every time he has faced the electorate, has won massively and is still regarded as the most popular president in the world.
Yes. I think it was something like his polls went down to like 90% approval, which is outstanding.
And keep in mind that he's done this. He came into power the year before COVID started. He has managed to weather a pretty incredible storm that has been very ruinous in much of Latin America and in Central America as well. And he's managed to rise in popularity while doing this. So, I mean, it's an open question for me. I am one of those snooty folks who likes to sit in the rich world and go, you should pay attention to your constitution. This doesn't seem very democratic, blah, 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 blah. But I can also see the side of apparently the vast, vast, vast overwhelming majority of El Salvadoran people who seem to really adore this guy.
And the man gets results?
So far.
Oh, definitely so far. I think another thing that was controversial, which at the moment isn't going well, was it's the first country to make a Bitcoin legal tender.
That's a very interesting move that he made, and I think it has unquestionably been disastrous. I am a huge opponent of crypto, as you know. But what's interesting is, thinking about this over the past couple of days, I think that his Bitcoin thing was a very clever way to neuter any larger scale attempts to overthrow him by the United States. Bitcoin is, and bear with me, this is a bit complicated. So Bitcoin is, I think, an anti-US power thing. Like, I think it, I mean, the only, you know, it's obviously nowhere near that, but the dreams of the founding of Bitcoin and many of its more passionate adherents is an alternative to the dollar, a new financial system, independence from any regulation, you know, fundamentally very libertarian and frankly a bit anarchist. However, that's not the way that it works with US elites. It has been heavily adopted by U.S. elites, specifically financial elites. You've seen in recent weeks, you've seen BlackRock.
Oh, yeah. They're buying a huge amount.
The epitome of, you know, the entity that owns like...
everything.
They own like a chunk of every company in the world. They're apparently putting together a Bitcoin ETF. I think JP Morgan wanted to get into it. Despite the fact that Bitcoin is about attacking America, American elites are all in because they have figured that it's a grift they can make money off of. No matter how much the Biden administration wants to complain about these anti-democratic moves, wants to sanction folks, wants to cut off aid, this, that, and the other thing. Bukele, by adopting this Bitcoin thing, by sort of sacrificing his country as a guinea pig for the further adoption of Bitcoin, is really helping out anybody who's into Bitcoin. And there are a lot of elite, wealthy figures that pay. Not, you know, it's not just Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. No, like very established people in Silicon Valley, very established people on Wall Street who are really invested in his weird Bitcoin experiment panning out. And one of the great things about El Salvador being such a tiny place is that it's easy if, you know, three coastal billionaires in the United States want this country of 6 million to be more successful. It will be. And they will also exert their influence in Washington, D.C. to make sure that nobody does anything about this Democratic backsliding. And I don't think that the Biden administration really cares about the Democratic backsliding. I think what the Washington, D.C. deeply cares about, and I think Bukele is aware is a real problem for him, is how pissed off the Drug Enforcement Administration is, how pissed off the United States military-industrial complex is, because he seems to have solved the problem of gangs and violence in his country, is not what the United States wants.
No.
Sorry, that is what the U.S. taxpayer wants. That is what the U.S. politicians may want. That is what the interests of humanity and the higher interests of the United States want. That is not the interest of the U.S. security services and the U.S. national security state. People have this being like, oh, the border's a disaster. Drug policy is a disaster or what have you in the United States. No, it's not. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. The purpose of these programs, the purpose of the politics around them, is to give jobs to cops. And what Bukele has done by, if only briefly, shutting down the gangs and crime problem in El Salvador, is he has taken jobs away from U.S. cops. And that is a really
given them to his own cops.
Given them to his own cops. But actually, like, you can employ, Mexico's providing a great example of, you can employ dramatically more cops and military. You know, they're famously AMLO is militarizing Mexico in interesting ways. You can employ many more cops and military folks without solving the problem. Bukele seems to actually be, at least briefly, solving the problem through very authoritarian means. And solving that problem makes Washington, D.C. incensed. So actually, that Bitcoin move that he made, that supposedly is crazy and probably not in the interest of the El Salvadoran people, was actually kind of necessary.
Keeps the tech bros on site.
Necessary bribe. And it's not just the tech bros, it's the finance bros now too. The necessary bribe for U.S. elites to keep the true interest behind the U.S. drug war, the sort of mass of national security types, from killing him, frankly.
Well, I have from what I understand, there seems to be a help for the people, because this is a country much like Cuba where nobody really wants to store or use their currency.
Mm-hmm.
So quite often the American dollar is the backup, our main currency in a lot of ways. So I feel Bitcoin gives them two escape valves. So the way Bitcoin tends to work is in 4 yearly cycles called halvings, where the miners basically get paid 50% less. And then roughly a couple of months later, maybe 6 months, that's when we see these big spikes. So it tends to do its own thing. I think the last time was the first time it ever lined up with, you know, the outside world when it had its big peak. So it's very possible that we could have something where the dollar's not doing great, but Bitcoin's doing well. So that means El Salvador can benefit from that. And then if the opposite happens...
I have a lot of problems with that narrative, Rory.
Okay. So let me see. By 2024, so halfway through 2024, 2025, it should pass all-time highs. Because he has done very badly at the moment. And then there is the volcano they're using to mine Bitcoin, which... does have James Bond baddie vibes.
Yeah, I don't really believe an interesting thing to look at the Bitcoin spikes on sort of a logarithmic scale is just sort of, yes, there have been spikes, but if you consider those spikes have been somewhat exponentially smaller each time.
Oh, like yes, yes. The longer trends, but then, yes, diminishing returns each time.
Well, I think the 2017 spike was something like 10x. I don't know what the 2009 spike was. It was 100x or whatever. And really, the 2021 spike that everyone got so excited about was 2x, and it's already been completely wiped out, you know? I think a lot of the talk of the halving strikes me as a little more theology than something to rely upon. And it's certainly not something you should rely upon as a state attempting to make decisions. That said, I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe, you know, maybe it is. El Salvador has rather signally failed to operate a functional currency. I believe, I should have tracked this down. It was a question I had and I didn't track this down. I mean, the U.S. dollar is the official currency of El Salvador.
Yeah.
I think they
give or take.
I don't know whether for some purposes they maintain an El Salvadoran currency. I should have looked into that. But dollarization is official economic policy, El Salvador. And adding Bitcoin, I mean, it's risky. And people who, I mean, the timing of it was just atrocious.
Oh, yeah.
September 2021 is when Bukele adopted the Bitcoin policy. And the peak was November 2021. So literally 2 months before the peak.
Yeah.
Bukele bought in, and it has collapsed by at least 50% since then. Bitcoin and Ethereum, very little up, but Bitcoin and Ethereum are holding on to more of their value than
I. But I think it also helps for, you know, sending money back home, people at work, say in America, and it is much easier way of sending money about. So there are advantages to it. I don't think it's completely ludicrous.
We'll have to disagree on that.
But it is a very young person thing to do. I can't see an 80-year-old president.
It now seems much more rational than I had thought, as a essentially sacrificing the country to the plaything of U.S. elites. That makes a lot of sense, and that actually helps him survive the fact that his anti-crime policies seem to have shut down the gravy train for the DEA. It was just fascinating looking into the numbers because people love to hide the numbers. You know, I was in the Congressional Research Service document I was looking through. They're like, oh, you know, we give 70 million. Also, just consider how low these numbers are.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. aid to El Salvador on an annual basis for non-military purposes is between $70 and $100 million.
How many schools would that build in America? Like four?
Two or three? Depends on the region.
Okay.
In Arizona, you could probably build 10 schools with that kind of money. In New York, you could build a tenth of one. You know, in New York City, you could build a tenth of one, I bet.
70. So not a lot of money. This is almost like, I'm sure even the city of New York would laugh at money like that.
Well, I mean, we'd take it as a gift, but we wouldn't.
Oh, yeah, but it's not like no one's going to be too worried about that amount of money.
Yeah, it's laughably little. Yeah, because I think we give Egypt $2 billion a year. We give Israel $3 billion a year. And this country that is pretty strategically important, you know, very close to the United States, a source.
And is democratic, which America says it's very passionate about, and has done well to significantly reduce drug crime.
Yeah.
You'd think they would be all over El Salvador?
Yeah, supposedly the border is something we care. But the thing is, we don't actually care about the border. We want there to be convoys coming up there so we can continue to spend tens of billions of dollars on employing cops at the border. That's what the real policy is. So obviously we're not really supporting, but it is striking just how little we have given them, considering how close they are and how strategically important they are and how deep the relationship between the countries are. I in Washington, D.C., because of the 1979 to 1992 Civil War, there were vast populations of refugees, and a lot of them landed in the Washington, D.C. area. So I spent my 20s, I believe pupusas are Salvadoran, and just amazing little sort of cheese and meat dish, really just. But anyway, so there's a huge Salvadoran population. So it's shocking how little money we give them. And the Congressional Research Service is like, oh, yeah, and we've only, you know, and we only really give like $1 million to the defense thing. And then, of course, you know, in a footnote, but actually, if you look into the the Central American Regional Security Initiative, which is basically money for cops, which is giving U.S. agencies, the DEA, the Defense Department, you know, ways to operate with the security agencies in these countries. You know, they broke that out separately, and we gave the same amount of money to militarization of El Salvador as we gave to absolutely every other form of aid. It's either about the same as everything else that we do, you know, building schools, providing water, education, and the other thing. We give the same amount of money to militarizing El Salvador. And it's all defense-related stuff. And all of this is made largely pointless and more difficult to translate into paydays for Washington, D.C. consultancies, weapons manufacturing companies, the whole nasty mess, retired generals, the whole nasty mess, when you do what Bukele did and seems to have largely solved the problem. Even worse, Guatemala seems to be very interested in doing exactly what Bukele did. So imagine that, actually solving Central American crime and destruction. There'd be nobody showing up at the border anymore. We could actually stop, you know, we could cut the amount of
these terrifying caravans.
That's terrifying to most of Washington, D.C. So it is fascinating. And I do think he really had to do this Bitcoin thing as a bribe for U.S. elites to let him solve some of El Salvador's problems, which is kind of extraordinary. It is fascinating that the Biden administration and the Trump administration, so basically Washington, D.C. in general, were really angry at him for negotiating with the gangs. Now that he has turned on the gangs in a particularly massive way, we're even angrier.
Do you think he's doing well, or is there much you don't like about him? Is there anything, what do you see about him that you think isn't going to end well?
If he were in charge of any jurisdiction,
you'd be terrified.
As a citizen, no, I'd be doing everything I could to.
Well, because there have been reports of, you know, people being arrested, because it seems like they kind of just arrest a lot of people that look a bit gangstery. So there was a case of there a man only being released after a year being in jail, which I wouldn't want to be in this jail.
Yeah, no
question. Seems terrifying.
There's no question that the human rights violations are extreme. The center, it's like sort of like the Center for Terrorist Defeating or something. He built a prison.
A brand new prison.
A brand new prison that can house like 40,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Makes it one of the biggest in the world.
If not the biggest. This is a horrifying thing, Rory. And this is always really troubling. China did this briefly with the Xinjiang thing. If you as a country ever have more people incarcerated than the United States does, then you're clearly a totalitarian nightmare space. Because the United States, except for a couple of years there during the Xinjiang thing, has since the Cold War by far incarcerated the most people. It's a national shame. It's a national horror. And if you're a country who's managing, especially a country as poor as El Salvador, who's managing that level of horrific
incarceration. So that's roughly 1% of their population. As I say, it's basically everyone that was in a gang is now in jail.
I think 2%.
Oh, wow.
And it's not, and let's be clear, it's not, you know, the government says they're gang members.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely sweeping up people who just had tattoos, who for whatever reason may, I'm not saying this is like unreservedly a good thing, but what is clear is that he is immensely popular in El Salvador, immensely legitimately popular. What is clear, as is being begrudgingly admitted by international news agencies, is that since this crackdown in March of 2022, the people of El Salvador feel liberated, frankly.
Yeah, it definitely has that vibe. They're saying that streets that, you know, no one really walked down now are vibrant and have markets. It just looks like a place you genuinely want to go to.
So there's no question that there's horrific human rights abuses, like U.S. level human rights abuses in their prisons. It's really like it's
just put up like humiliating photographs of them all kind of only wearing underwear, all like in a row. I don't know how to describe it. So like humiliating them on Twitter, which is something else he's very good at, is he's very media savvy.
Yeah. And that seems to just make him more and more popular with the voters.
But was this new prison, not because of like a night of violence. Was there not like, it felt like he had a deal and then there was like the violence shot up and he was like, right, and no more deals. I'm just going to round things all up.
Yeah. In March of 2022, in a single weekend, and it's honestly the timing of that, and I'm surprised I didn't see anybody else suggesting that, but the timing of it seemed a little too, convenient. Or it could very well have been, you know, he simply got to a point where, so yes, this is March of 2022, in a single weekend, in a single day, I think 62 people were murdered across the country, which was, can be construed as the gangs no longer, you know, whatever deal they had with Bukele, they threw out of the window. Of course, Bukele probably threw out that deal in whatever, you know, I don't know, all he would have had to have done probably would have been like, you know, freeze some account or something. And, you know, took that action knowing there would be a cartel action and then used that, because he was then prepared, used that action to suspend the Constitution, frankly. It is a state of emergency that started in March of 2022, continues to this day. Basic rights have been thrown out the window. I think you're supposed to see a judge after 15 days now, which is, you know, rather than more quickly than that, but who knows how that's actually being observed. Folks have been arrested in droves. It is, by any measure, you know, completely against the spirit of any human rights declaration that is present in any country. And it goes on today. And that was, I mean, that's the point. Because remember, before March of 2022, he was being sanctioned by the Biden administration for being too close to the game. But, you know, it seems to have worked. It is fascinating just for my thesis about, you know, the elite loving, you know, Bukele, the U.S. elites loving Bukele, is I looked him up in Bloomberg and everything was about how surprisingly well El Salvador has been meeting its debt commitments, despite the Bitcoin, despite having trouble with the IMF and the U.S. because of the Bitcoin thing.
Yes, it did get downgraded to like very risky into C, wasn't it? It's like CAA, something like that.
Not as familiar as I should be with the various rating agencies' approaches. But yeah, C, I do know C is not good.
Yes.
Definitely not good. But yeah, these reports are just talking about how it's amazing. They're celebrating the fact that he paid off El Salvador's debt when it was due. So like they're like celebrating in Bloomberg for not defaulting. So it is kind of interesting, just sort of these.
Well, I think some good news is when I was looking up, there wasn't a lot of news on El Salvador, which I generally think's good.
Yeah, and I think that what we're seeing is sort of belated realizations on a lot of folks that what he did in March of 2022 still seems to be working.
He's going to need to rehabilitate these men, because you can't just keep 2% of your population in jail indefinitely. I know some of them have done horrific things and probably deserve a good 20 years, but some of them are just going to be small time.
I was thinking about that myself, like what kind of processing is he doing? And I'm sure there's programs for that as well. But what's interesting is I do think he's got, I think in through means that aren't particularly obvious and were not really covered on the top level, I do think that his government and El Salvador more generally is now benefiting from investment and possibly quieter investments from folks who really like this Bitcoin thing. Because yeah, I mean, he's not just paying off debt when it's due, he's prepaying some stuff. And yeah, El Salvador not being the murder capital of the world anymore.
It's always a great thing to have.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It has led to more tourism investment. And I mean, who's to say, I mean, this guy's rise has been meteoric. What larger ambitions does he have?
Aware of anybody funding him from outside? Like, is he part of a shadowy cabal or is he fairly self-funded?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, shadowy cabal is a very loaded terminology.
It is very loaded.
If you look at things in the right lens, anything can look like a shadowy cabal.
Oh, definitely.
There's no question in my mind that he, along with most any other politician, has got money from places that require promises that the people who voted for him might not like. That's pretty universal. It is fascinating just how much he's been able to throw out the standard way of doing business.
Would you consider him to be an autocrat?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's taken actions to I think you can break his presidency into sort of two two periods. There's the period before, you know, from June of 2019 until February of 2021, or whenever so the election was in February of 2021, and then through to today. So for over 2 years now, he has not only been the president. In February of 2021, in parliamentary elections, his brand new party, that I think had been kept off the ballot in 2019, won an overwhelming majority in the legislature.
Still very popular.
And when you've got those two, it only was a matter of time before the executive and the legislature together could team up to pack the court. Yeah, this comes up a lot with someone else that I'm really sympathetic to, someone that I'm much more sympathetic to than Bukele. Evo Morales constitutionally was not supposed to support, to seek a further term. And because he'd been magnificently successful in government of Bolivia, was able to appoint a bunch of people to the Supreme Court. I mean, he was president for, I think, a decade or something along those lines. Appointed a bunch of folks to the Supreme Court, and they said, no, he can. He's allowed to go for another term. And there was a coup in October of 2019, heavily supported by the United States and U.S.-funded organizations. And people were like, well, you know, according to the Constitution, and like, I don't think that's a justification for outside.
But you are allowed to amend constitutions.
Exactly.
And if he is genuinely popular, then there is a reasoning for it.
Exactly. Like they can be amended and they can be interpreted. And even if those interpretations are as transparently for the benefit of the popular leader as the interpretation in Bolivia and the interpretation in El Salvador have been, that doesn't mean they are illegitimate. And it certainly doesn't mean it gives outsiders the right to pick and choose leaders of this country, as we did in Bolivia. Just the size of his mandate is extraordinary.
Oh, yeah, it's outstanding.
I mean, we talked a lot about Erdogan on this podcast, who is a guy who has managed to just keep winning elections, but he wins elections by razor-thin margins. And truly half of the country has
changing his politics on a day.
Yes. And truly half of the country has always hated Erdogan. The question now is whether Bukele can create a sustainable political system in El Salvador without Bukele. I mean, the guy...
Or just become a dictator?
Yeah, the guy is barely 40. I think, you know, he won these elections fair and square. He is not someone who took power illegitimately. He is certainly consolidating his power in ways that are very troubling, actions that are very troubling. But in the first decade of Erdogan or even Putin, they took a lot of actions that were questionable that actually brought benefits. And it's that crucial question is Bukele going to be content with two terms? And then, you know, so he's going to, unless something changes dramatically, 8 months or so, he is going to get a second term as president, another 5-year term. So is he going to be content to be president for 10 years? Is he going to be, you know, can he craft a successor? Because presumably he's going to want to keep his Nueva Ideas.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, a party in power beyond him. Is he going to be able to?
Or hopefully the other parties would try to copy him, or possibly he's created such a change that it's like this gang mentality might be destroyed forever.
Yeah. And well, what's also really interesting is seeing how he manages to leverage power across Central America. Remember, we started at the beginning talking about how throughout the 19th century, as many as 70 years after independence from Spain, these countries were talking about the possibility of some kind of union. I don't think that's a real possibility, but so, you know, he may. I mean, look at this guy's meteoric rise from small town mayor at 31 to essentially on most powerful person in El Salvador.
The EU started off as a glorified farmers market.
If they're
you know, agreeing with each other to trade with each other more so, and they tend to have similar issues, they could work together.
Yeah, so Bukele might have ambitions in that direction, which could be tremendously positive for the region.
Just the worry would be America, I don't think, would like a stabilization, it seems.
Well, it is The question is, and it's fascinating, you talk about American empire politics. That's what Bukele is doing. He realized that he had to cater to
America,
a section of the U.S. elite to stop the crime, to be allowed to assert sovereignty and take El Salvador's own approach. And if he can continue to play those politics, because one of the great virtues or virtues of his position is that the true interests in the United States that favor chaos on the border, favor ongoing poverty in Central America, can't come out and say that. And if he manages to continue the economic success, this, that, and the other thing, and turn El Salvador into a place that people want to go, a source of investment, a place where people can make...
A stable country?
Well, I don't think anybody was talking about... there is a Central American Free Trade Agreement, and this came in... I think this was under the second Bush, actually. It was when CAFTA started out. And the result of that is that the United States has a $1.6 billion trade surplus with El Salvador. We don't have trade surpluses with many countries, especially to have a trade surplus with a country that is as poor as El Salvador. That looks kind of exploitative to me, frankly. But what a safer El Salvador could conceivably do, Mexico can do, but is beginning to lose its ability to do. Yeah, so El Salvador could compete with Mexico for factories at a lower price point.
It's also, they wouldn't need a lot of factories. They could easily specialize in something.
Yeah.
With such a small population and still let Mexico be more broad.
Sure. Yeah, but that's the amazing and really frustrating thing about Central America more generally, is that they're so small. These countries are so small and are such a source of instability because of poverty and destruction that we have inflicted on them. El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua all had massive, horrific civil wars in the 80s, funded by the United States, created by the United States. And it would take so little. You know, if we just took the money that we give to Egypt every year, those $2 billion, and spread them around Central America, variety of programs, it would be... deserts blooming overnight. I mean, it wouldn't be, miraculous, but it would be pretty close. So it would take so little and provide so little threat to anybody to help these countries prosper. And Bukele's success here is an indicator of just this tremendous opportunity we've been missing. We should stop missing, I think.
So would this be one of our most positive episodes?
Yeah. I mean, which is surprising to me because when I started...
You were skeptical?
3 days ago, I was ready to be like, screw Bukele. And to be clear, I mean, I'm not coming out completely positive. I mean, he really seems like a first decade Putin or Erdogan. It's not a ringing endorsement, but there are positive choices and positive shifts that can be made here. And I look forward to seeing what's next in El Salvador.
And we'll be looking forward to hearing from you next on our next episode of the More Freedom Foundation podcast.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.